wonderful colleague from the Biological Sciences Department, Aaron Rydell. He is a second year PhD student, and he's going to talk to all of you about feedback and student regulation and all kinds of really awesome topics. If you haven't been to our workshops before, my name is Katie Kelly. I'm the Assistant Director for PI. And of course, we have our wonderful director, Dr. Lisa Lucino, and our fabulous GA Fong. So if anybody else wants to say anything, go ahead. If not, then Aaron can take it away.
Awesome. So I guess I will take it away then. So welcome, everyone. A big thank you to the people who helped put all of this together and get this started. So a big thank you to Melanie Medina, who is the Department of Biology's PI liaison. She's wonderful, and she and I have been talking about this workshop since starting here at the university. So a big thank you to her for getting this off the ground, and a huge thank you to Katie, who's been really supportive in this entire process, working to get all the logistics sorted along with Fong to get everything situated and sorted and ready for today. And then a big thank you to Dr. Lucino and the rest of the PI team. If you've not been to many of these workshops, they are a very diverse group of informational workshops on everything that we cover in teaching, everything that you should know about teaching or that you might want to know about teaching as a profession. I can only give you a limited overview of knowledge in this workshop, but if you're interested in other workshops, just look out for them. Even if you can only go for 30 minutes, they're super valuable and you'll learn something great and something new to improve your own teaching in the classroom. Today's workshop is obviously about giving and receiving feedback and improving student self-regulation and developing an honest classroom culture, which we hope to do with all of our students here at the university. I am a big goal-oriented person. You'll learn very quickly that I love checklists, to-do lists, and goals. And so we do have four goals for today, and we'll revisit them at the end. The first three goals are goals that we hope to accomplish today through this workshop. And the fourth goal is a goal for the future. I'm big on looking towards the future and thinking about what can I do to improve myself over this next year or over these next 2 years. So this last goal of applying effective feedback or feed forward skills in your own teaching practices, hopefully you can incorporate some of the strategies we talk about today in your future teaching practices to make yourself a better educator. Just a couple of notes before we do get started on everything. There is going to be a lot of information today, and if you can't take it all in because your brain is so bogged down by information, that's okay. This will be recorded. You will have the ability to view this later on if you want to take notes or anything, or if you want to contact me and talk about some of these things, I'm happy to talk after. We will also have a question and answer session at the very end, but if you do have a question throughout the presentation and you're afraid that you're going to forget it, feel free to toss it right into chat, and either Katie or Fong will make sure that I have that question at the very end to address. I know how hard it is to remember your question for an hour long presentation or an hour plus presentation, so feel free to use chat if you have a question. Our agenda for today, it seems rather short, but we're gonna dive into some of these in quite depth. So the first thing is a brief about me and getting to know you all a little bit. I did get some basic information about you from the registration information, but you know very little probably about me, although 3/4 of you are from my department. There is some information that you still might not know about me and why I'm the person giving this presentation and this workshop. We'll talk a little bit about the background on feedback, what it is, why it's effective, why it's necessary, and what our students think as they approach college learning. We'll talk about methods of giving and receiving feedback. So how do I give feedback to my own students? And how should I be receiving feedback from my learners or from my supervisors as I'm working towards my degree or working in the field? How to use feedback to support students is the second last of our agenda items. So before we get into, or after we get into giving and receiving feedback, we need to talk about how do I use that feedback? How do I give feedback to my students that will really support their learning? And how do I give effective feedback? Because there are some ways that we provide feedback to our students that really aren't effective or supported by educational literature. And then finally, The one that I think is the most interesting is how and when should I as an educator incorporate feedback that I get from either students, from peers, from colleagues, or from my supervisors? When is the most appropriate time? And what does research have to say about when should I be incorporating feedback? And we'll talk a little bit about FSU specifics in this last category, because we'll talk about how to use the teaching evaluations that you might get from your TA responsibilities if you are a TA here at the university. So a brief about me. As Katie said, I am a second year PhD student in the Department of Biological Sciences. My focus is ecology and evolution with a specific focus on ocean pollution. If you're interested in any of that, that's a whole nother workshop that I can give on ocean pollution. Feel free to talk to me about that. But my background in teaching started with my bachelor's degree. So I have a bachelor's in biology with an initial teaching certification from SUNY Geneseo, which is one of the many state schools in New York. And the way that college in New York works, and education specifically in New York works, is that if you are going to school to teach for any level other than elementary education, you cannot get a degree in education. You have to get a degree in your content area. So that's why my degree is in biology. But I have an initial teaching certification because alongside your biology degree, you are also double majoring essentially in education to earn enough credits to teach. My focus in teaching at my bachelor's was in assistive education, working with underrepresented groups, students who struggle with learning, and specifically I was a one-on-one aide for a deaf student who is taking college courses. So I was translating between ASL, English, and Spanish. For the student as we were working to get her through her education. I earned my Master's of Science in Education in Biology Education, which is one of the worst names for a degree ever, from SUNY Brockport with a professional teaching certification. So my master's is in education, and my focus from a master's was on student metacognition and self-regulation strategies, also known as feedback, how students incorporate feedback into their everyday lives, how students perceive feedback, and specifically working with underrepresented groups, students who are first college students in their family, or students who are BIPOC, or students who have cultural differences between their home culture and school culture, working with those students to make them successful in education. And I spent 3 years teaching public school at the secondary level, and then 2 years teaching at the college level before coming to FSU. So that's my teaching background. Here at the university, I've taught a couple of courses in our Department of Biology. So the most foundational courses from biology lab. Right now I'm teaching in upper level biology lab, and I've also served as the head teaching assistant responsible for teaching graduate students who are teaching our course. So I've served at all different levels of teaching within our department. And now it's time for a brief about you. We are going to do a couple of different get to know you activities or polls or questionnaires throughout today's session. Please know that these are completely anonymous. I have no idea who is answering what on these, which is part of developing an honest classroom culture, is that I am forward with you about my expectations and that you are open and honest with providing responses. So I won't know who is saying what for these questions that we're asking. So please feel free to answer them honestly, because your experiences might be very similar to someone else's. And that might be really supportive of that other individual who's thinking that they might be alone in how they understand feedback in this case, or how they understand education in general. So these are completely anonymous questions. And these are just brief get to know you type questions for you to answer. So the first poll I'm launching right now, it has two separate questions on it. So the first question is, what formal training or education do you have in providing feedback? So do you have formal education or classes that you've taken? Do you have informal education in providing feedback or job experience? Do you have no formal training but have gone to a prior workshop? And please don't count this workshop, because you haven't gone to it just yet. You've just started your journey. Or do you have no training nor education in providing feedback? And then the second one, for how long have you been a teacher? So maybe you've never taught a class before. Maybe you've taught for your entire life and you are taking another workshop as you go to learn more about teaching. Or maybe you have less teaching experience altogether. And TA orientation does count. Yes, I saw in chat that TA orientation does count. So If you chose something else and you're like, oh no, I need to go back, don't worry. It's okay. This is just so I have a basic understanding of where everyone is at in the workshop. And we've got a lot of answers coming in. Wonderful. And I think I just saw Katie put my email in chat, but if you have any questions later on, feel free to email me. And if you forget that, I'm in the Department of Biology. You can look me up on our webpage. I'm pretty easy to find, or all of the PI information that you got sent out today has information about me in it. Wonderful. So it looks like everyone answered the poll. So let me share those results with you so you can see what's going on. So for the first question, what formal training or education do you have in providing feedback? Most people said some sort of informal education or job experience. 38% of us said that was the case. Some of us have no formal training, but have gone to a workshop of some sort. Many of us don't have training nor education in this, and some of us have formal education or classes. This is not surprising, this spread, because feedback and providing feedback is often not well taught as we move into fields of education. It's often not a course that you take when you're getting a degree in education. And when you're not earning a degree in education and you're going to work in a job for the first time, they're probably not providing you much specific training on providing feedback to others. The second question, for how long have you been a teacher? A couple of us have little teaching experience. Many of us have 2 to 5 years of teaching experience, which is awesome. Keep teaching, keep doing what you're doing. We need you out in the field. And some of us have more than 5 years of experience. I bow down to all of you who have more than 5 years of experience because I know what that's like. I know that it can be challenging. You just keep doing it. And if it ever gets too much, just remember, take a little break, take a breather, have a Snickers, whatever you need to do, just relax. You're doing great work. And we'll have a couple more polls, like I said, as today goes along. Simple questions, just so I can get to know all of you and your experiences as we go through talking about feedback. And that brings us to our background on feedback. We already have checked off the first thing on our agenda. So a brief background on feedback. The first thing for us to understand before we even talk about providing feedback to students is, what are our students thinking? They are by far the most important individuals in our field because we are working with them every single day, or maybe every other day, depending on how your class is structured. And so some of these items are taken from specific studies, some of them are taken from correspondences. But one thing that's really clear to us in educational literature is that there's a difference between secondary education skills and college education skills. So secondary education skills could be anything from middle school, traditionally 5th through 8th grade. Some middle schools in the US are 6th through 8th grade. And those also go all the way through high school. Well, as post-secondary, those are our college skills. And at the secondary education level, the skills that we ask our students to do a lot of times are remembering and understanding skills. So when you think back to your experience in high school or maybe even in middle school, the tests that you are probably taking were, what's 6 times 7? And that's like I understand how to do this mathematics problem. Or in biology, a lot of times it was, label this microscope. Oh, I remember all the different parts of a microscope. They were very foundational skills. But we find that at the college level, we're asking our students to apply and analyze more than we're asking them to remember and understand. Now, I know many of you have sat in classes where you're jotting down a whole bunch of notes on a topic and you have to memorize words and definitions, but a lot of the skills that we're actually asked to do are applying and analyzing, whether that's through our own research, whether that's through writing a laboratory report, whether we're analyzing an author's theme or their motivation, or we're looking at a character, maybe we're applying a new idea to a field. Those are the skills that we really see using in college classes. And we also find that there's a challenge in our students of differentiating knowledge of cognition versus regulation of cognition. And sometimes we hear students say, I don't know what I don't know, not realizing what they don't know. And that can be quite frustrating. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges with providing feedback and challenges that our students face and how we can subvert those challenges by supporting them in the classroom. We also find a lot of times, and this might have gone for you as well, that non-majors or general education courses are not worth my time. Maybe you felt like taking that one art history course or that one music in our lives course in college wasn't really worth it for you since you knew exactly where you wanted to go. But students are finding that, or students are suggesting and telling their instructors that they don't see the purpose of these other courses if they're going to just narrow the scope of their field to chemistry or to astrophysics or to creative writing. They don't see the need for science or mathematics courses that aren't relevant to their work. Where in fact, we do find that those courses are actually probably more important to us as individuals than maybe we have accounted for. So doing things like being able to file your taxes. Maybe you took a basic economics course and you remember a little bit about how to file taxes or how to invest in stocks in the stock market. Those items from maybe our general education courses that we're not really thinking about all the time that are applicable to our lives. The last one, and this is the most common one, and I know you've heard this before, you probably hear your students say, I'm prepared for college because I did well in high school. This is the student that comes up to you after taking a test or after turning in an assignment and they don't do well and they say, well, I don't know why I didn't do well. I did fine in high school, or I did fine in this other college course that I had. Therefore, you must be a bad teacher. Which is not the case. You are not a bad teacher. They just don't have the proper expectations of the work required of them at the college level. And so our students have a disconnect between what I needed in high school versus what I need in college. And so that brings us to metacognition, or a brief overview on metacognition, which was the focus of my master's degree. So metacognition, or thinking about thinking, is what metacognition means. Can be broken down into two separate sub areas. We have knowledge of cognition, which is knowledge of oneself as a learner, and knowledge about learning strategies and when to use them. So you might know that you work really well when you make flashcards. You work really well when you make lists or diagrams. You're a very visual learner. That's knowledge of cognition. It's knowledge about how do I learn best. And then we have regulation of cognition, which is the awareness of comprehension and the evaluation of learning strategies. So it's the ability of an individual to say, oh, I know that I know this information now, or, oh, I used this one specific strategy to prepare for this economics test, and it didn't go well for me. So maybe I should change up the way that I'm approaching studying for this subject. And as a note here, students are usually moderately competent with knowledge of cognition, but disparagingly poor with regulation of cognition. Your students probably know themselves as a learner. They've gotten a lot of time to realize themselves as learners. They haven't spent a lot of time thinking about how they assess themselves, that self-regulation aspect of learning. Benefits of cognition include reducing skill gaps and achievement gaps. So maybe you have a broad, heterogeneous audience that you're teaching towards. Metacognition, or being able to understand oneself as a learner and regulate one's learning, can significantly reduce skill gaps between your high achievers and your low achievers. And it also supports long-term improvements in learning with rather low investments. So to make large gains in your learning, you really just need to know, where am I currently at? Where do I want to be going? And what are my steps to get there? And so that investment is rather low, and we'll talk about how we support those steps later on. Some obstacles to be aware of is that metacognition and self-regulation are not taught in schools. This might be the first time you're hearing of them unless you've taken educational psychology, but they're not taught in schools. We don't teach these skills in schools unless you're teaching them at the elementary school level, because my experience teaching at the middle and high school level, we don't teach these things. We just tell students how to study, and that's it. That's what we do. Another obstacle is that linear teaching models, so models of teaching that are, we're going to go from this topic to this topic, and we're just going to build on each other at one level, don't always persist at another. For example, in general education courses, maybe we have a linear model of history where we're working from the 1700s to the 1900s, and we're looking at literature, and we're just moving one step to the next. But linear teaching models don't always work in every single field. We might have more circular models where we're kind of circling back. We start with a topic and then we build around that topic. So the challenge with that is that it makes thinking about one's learning a little bit more challenging when we are using different teaching styles. But that's okay because different teaching styles support different types of learners. Lastly, student challenges at the collegiate level specifically, and this is from a meta-analysis of a number of different studies, is that college students struggle the most with adjusting study and time management habits. So our students at the college level tend to struggle most with time management. You probably know that because they come to you at the last minute to say, oh my gosh, I forgot that our paper was due, or I forgot we had a test today, or they have trouble studying. And we'll talk a little bit about ways that we can support our students, their study habits, their time management habits today, as we think about how do we provide effective feedback to our students. So our next poll, poll 2 of 3, and this is a quiz for all of you. And by quiz, I mean not a quiz because it's not being graded, but I wanna see what you know. Some of you said that you have an understanding of feedback. You've gotten some formal training on feedback. So this is going to be a poll on the modes or classifications of feedback. So let me launch this poll for you. So the poll question for this one is, how many different modes of feedback are there that we as educators can provide to our students? So how many different modes? And if you don't know, take your best guess, because that's how polls work, that you get to just choose one. Got a lot of answers coming in. Thank you all for answering all of these. This is really great because it gets me seeing where all of you are at. Just a couple more answers coming in. Wonderful. Okay, let's see where we are. And let's share these results with everyone. So it looks like there was a tie between 3 and 5 or more. Some said 2, some said 4, no one said 1. Congratulations that no one said 1 because there's more than 1, which you probably realized. If you didn't realize that, you realized that, yay. But there's definitely more than 1 way that we can provide feedback to our students. So let's see how many different ways there are. There are 3, by the way, and we'll talk about each of those 3 in turn. If you said there were more, we'll actually talk about some things that you might think of modes of feedback, but are a little bit different. But let's talk about feedback first and why it's important. And I've underlined the key points of what feedback is, the definition of feedback. And this is the most widely used definition of feedback in educational literature. The goal of feedback is to help students essentially get where they are, or get from where they are to get to where they are going. So modify what they're currently doing to reduce that gap in their learning or in their education. And there are some assumptions that we are making when we set this goal. One of the assumptions is that students are open to feedback. We assume that our students will actually make those changes that we are suggesting to modify their actions and their thinking to reduce that gap. So that's one of the assumptions we make when we make this definition. We also make the assumptions that our students perceive that the individual giving them feedback is an authority of some sort. Now, you might not think of yourself as an authority. I generally don't think of myself as an authority because I like to build a more kind of social interaction with students as opposed to that authoritarian relationship. But your students must perceive that you have some level of knowledge that is really going to help them. A lot of times that is inherent because they see, oh, the TA is grading me or my educator is grading me. They have some authority on how this is going to work and what this is going to look like. The last one is that students are motivated and interested in achieving. We make that assumption that our students actually want to bridge that gap from where they are to where they want to be. And I would say that that assumption is probably valid for the most part. We assume that our students are in college because they want to learn, they want to achieve, they want to succeed, but you might have some students that are a little bit more resilient to gaining feedback and to making that jump from where they are to where they want to be. feedback is actually more strongly related to achievement than any other teaching behavior. So you might be an awesome teacher, you might do fun dances and fun songs, and you might make up cool acronyms for different things that you're teaching. But if you're not giving great feedback, then your students are still going to struggle. And we'll talk about ways that you can provide feedback using some of the FSU resources that we have here. And if you're interested in providing feedback and you're not teaching at FSU, I have some resources for that as well. And like I said, there are three types of feedback. Two are considered more often than the third. So the first two are the ones that most people know about. So verbal or oral feedback, that would be talking to an individual or saying great job, or this was awesome, or that was a great presentation, those types of things, oral responses. And then written or textual feedback. And those are the comments that you leave on papers, that you put on tests, that you write on assignments that students are turning in. Maybe they're turning in a portfolio and you're jotting down notes for them. Maybe you're filling out a rubric. That would be written or textual feedback. The last one is one that we often don't think about that is rather important, and that's socio-emotional feedback. We don't give it enough credit because it's very hard to change our socio-emotional feedback because a lot of times that is involuntary. So it's the gestures that we are using, the way that we're moving about, our pacing, our body language, things that we just do in the classroom. Maybe these some inherent biases come out with our social emotional feedback. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but I want to spend most of our time talking about things that we can actively do through our verbal or oral feedback and our written or textual feedback. And these are the modes of feedback, these three modes, but there are also different types of constructive feedback. So if you were thinking about, oh, maybe there's more than three modes of feedback, you might've been thinking about types of constructive feedback. So that's a whole nother category of feedback. And I have this lovely chart for you from Hattie and Timperley. They did a really great job of turning feedback into a really nice chart that you can just go down. So we talked about the purpose of feedback, so to reduce discrepancies between current understanding, so bridging that gap. There's different ways that we can reduce that discrepancy. So students can put in an increased effort, they can do more work. Great, yeah, tell students to do more work. That's a great way of doing it. Students can abandon their original goals. Also not a great thing, but it's something that they can do if they want to bridge that gap. They can say, oh, let's just make the gap smaller. And instead of shooting from a 60 to a 90, maybe I go from a 60 to a 70. That might be appropriate. Teachers can provide appropriate, challenging, and specific goals. So we can modify our goals to make them challenging, but at an easier level, so a stepwise level. Or we can assist students to reach them through effective learning strategies and feedback, which is what we'll focus on. And this is my favorite part of the chart that they have here. It's effective feedback answers three questions. So the first question, where am I going? What are my goals? That's known as feed up. Terrible terminology, but it's called feed up. That's fine. Where am I going? What is my goal? What am I trying to accomplish? How am I going is feedback. So how am I doing in that process of getting there? That's the thing that we are most commonly working with in our own classrooms, is providing feedback of the how. And then where to next is feed forward. Okay, I've gotten here, but now what do I do? What are my next steps? And that's called feed forward. And I'll skip the feedback questions because those we will get into in depth later on. And now we've gotten a brief background, a quick background on feedback. And now is the part that many of you are wondering, is how do I give feedback to my students? How do I support them with feedback? And how do they support me with feedback as well? And there are many, many ways to give feedback. There are far too many ways, in my opinion, as an educator, to give feedback. I've listed a couple of here. We've got rubrics to office hours, to meetings, to classroom cues, to anything that you could want. I remember when I was first getting into teaching and they said, here are some ways to give feedback. You can write little notes on sticky notes and put them on desks. So you can have little whiteboards on the corner of desks and write little notes to the students, but that's exhausting. And at the college level, if you are, you know, TAing at the college level, you're often doing your own research, you're doing your own coursework and you're teaching. So you have a lot to consider. And so my goal today is to really help you develop strategies or think about strategies that make giving feedback easier for you, more time effective for you, and less stressful for you. So that's some of the goals that we're working with today. And to do that, we're going to talk about just a few of these ways to give feedback. We're going to focus on these ones in bold because these are the ones that I think we can build the most from and we can save the most time on. So talking a little bit about rubrics and how we use rubrics, talking about annotating assignments, and test and assessment scores. What do these mean and how do we use these to support our students? And we will spend a very brief amount of time talking about verbal classroom cues, so oral feedback, and some of our nonverbal classroom cues, so the socio-emotional feedback. We won't talk about what to do on one-on-one meetings because I don't know what your one-on-one meetings look like, but mine are often 5-minute meetings of a student coming in and saying, I need help on this. Oh, okay, bye. So they're very, very short. We can spend more of our time on the big things, the rubrics, the annotations, and tests and assessment scores. And this slide has a lot of writing and a lot of information, and we're not going to go through all of it, but I wanted to throw it up there for you. This comes from Pearson, who is dominating education in the United States. If you're not familiar with Pearson, you've probably taken tests that they have given you for many, many years. But educational research actually tells us that effective feedback is built from 4 different categories that influence effective feedback. So we have to be thinking about our learner characteristics. So who are the people that we are working with and that we are teaching? Do they represent a heterogeneous audience? Are they first-year undergrads? Are they a mixed group? Are they all seniors ready to go into the career field? Who are our learners? What's the instructional context? So why does this feedback matter in what I'm doing right now? Maybe you're teaching a laboratory course. Maybe you're teaching a writing course. How do I give feedback that matters for the context of the instruction that I'm providing? The structure of our feedback is really important, and we'll talk about feedback structure in a little bit because there are some missteps that are often advised. So we'll talk about some things that people tell us to do when giving feedback that aren't supported by literature. And you might be surprised by some of these because I know some of you have heard them in your teaching careers. And then we'll talk about the feedback level, the level of feedback that we're providing. Am I giving too much feedback to my learners? Am I giving feedback at the right cognitive level for all of my learners? And there's different ways that we can build on deciding what level of feedback should I be providing. This information down here about task level feedback is beneficial for novice learners. So maybe it's a general education course. You might want to be giving task level feedback of, okay, for this task that you're working on, here are the things that you should be thinking about or that you might need to modify as you're approaching this task, as opposed to maybe you're in an upper level majors course you're teaching. You might give process and regulative feedback. So thinking about, okay, how am I going to use these in the field? What are the processes? What are the more complex systems that I'm working with? And so this is some guidelines for providing effective feedback. And we'll go into a lot more depth about ways to provide effective feedback with strategies, skills, etc. Throughout the presentation. So let's talk about what educational research tells us about feedback methods and start with rubrics. For those of you who went to my last talk for my department, I'm so sorry that you've heard some of this before, but I have new information for you, so don't worry. You've heard some of this, but not all of it. And I am a big fan of rubrics. I love rubrics because they tell the learners exactly what we expect from them as they turn in whatever the assignment is, whether it's a writing portfolio, an art portfolio, a history paper, a math assignment that we are grading. Rubrics tell the learner exactly what you are looking for, and they promote critical thinking and self-reflection because the learner should be able to go to the rubric and say, oh, here is what my professor expects. Here's what my paper has. Oh, I can see that there's a disconnect between what I have and what is expected of me. And that's promoting those self-reflection and self-regulation behaviors that we're looking to improve upon with our students. Now, rubrics should meet 3 standards, and I'll provide some examples of these on the next slide, but they should have evaluative criteria, so some criteria that they'll be evaluated on, some quality definitions for the criteria at levels, so what exactly you're looking for at those levels. So evaluative criteria might be things like grammar and spelling, or introduction, text, or it might be thesis or central idea. Those are your evaluative criteria. Your quality definitions would be, you know, for spelling and grammar, fewer than one spelling error throughout the entire piece. That might be your quality definitions. And then there also needs to be some sort of scoring strategy on your rubric, because they need to know the difference between the different levels. This next point is controversial. I still stand by it. I think it's a great point, but there's been some controversy in recent years in the educational literature. But many individuals say there should be an even number of rating scale levels on your rubric, meaning that your rubric should be out of 4 different grading scales or 6 and not 5 or 3. And the reason why is because in a research study that was done in the early 2000s on teachers evaluating student work, they found that teachers given an odd rating scale would always grade in the middle. They would always give that moderate. And by putting an even scale, they found that teachers were more likely to grade objectively rather than subjectively. So they're more likely to have to think critically about their idea because they couldn't just pick the middle. They had to pick one category versus the other. Again, this is controversial because some people say, well, it's not the best way to do it. Until there's a better way that's coming out, I'm going to stick with this, and I'm going to suggest this for anyone making rubrics themselves. Now, if you don't have to make rubrics, great. You don't have to worry about that, but it is just something to think about. Another thing about rubrics is we want to use quantitative methods to differentiate subjective categories. So in the example that I gave on spelling and grammar, you might see a rubric that says, has some spelling errors or few spelling errors, which can drive people crazy because what is your definition versus my definition of some and few? So we want to try and be as quantitative as possible with those categories, using numbers, using specific language that tells the student what we are looking for. And then the last one, which is supported by so many years of literature, is practice using the rubric, and when possible, have the students practice using the rubric as well. So have students practice using the rubric on each other so they can evaluate each other's work. That builds those metacognitive strategies, those self-regulation strategies that we've been talking about. And also by you practicing using the rubric, you're able to see how you are grading these works, and it allows you to figure out, is the rubric assessing exactly what I want it to assess. And I know for many of you in the biology department, you've had practice grading sessions where you practice using the rubric before actually using it. I hope in other departments that might be a thing. If not, maybe suggest it. Maybe suggest, hey, can we sit down and use a paper from a previous semester, and can we grade it using our grading scheme and see how we go? It improves inter rater reliability between grading, and it just really makes for great teamwork and a great intellectual conversations between evaluators. And like I said, I do have 2 rubric examples to talk about the items that I was just mentioning. So here's the first example. This is from Studiensky in 2015. This is a rubric for an assignment. So over here at the top, they have a task description or a title of the task. That's not necessary. That's just an extra thing that was added. But you can see that they have the criteria over here on the left. So that was the first thing that we said that we want. We have descriptors down here on the bottom or in the middle that tell you exactly what the author of this rubric is looking for. And there's a level of achievement. So that's that grading scale. Now they do obviously have a 3 system rubric, but I do like that they have all of the components here for their rubric. So they have the criteria, they have the quality evaluation information, and they have levels of achievement. We will talk about one other thing about this rubric because it's gonna follow the exact same way in the next rubric. There's something that I would like to point out that is very helpful and Canvas will do for you to make your rubrics even better. But our second example, there we go. So our second example is from a School of Management and University of Scranton. So again, they have the criteria over here on the left-hand side. They have very specific information about what they are looking for. Again, they do have some subjective things. So frequent errors in spelling and grammar, we might want to quantitatively assess what that is. And then they also have these grade categories, unacceptable, acceptable, target, and exemplary for their grading categories. Now, the one thing that both of these rubrics do that I might modify is that we find that students do better on assignments when the category that appears first on the rubric is the highest scoring value. So instead of this going from unacceptable to exemplary, we should switch this around because students are more likely to read the very first column and then skip everything else. You know how students are as readers. You might have been that student who was like, oh, I don't have enough time to read everything. So we actually do find that there is a significant difference between scoring on rubrics where students see the highest category first versus the lowest category first. Canvas, I believe, automatically does this for you and puts the highest scoring category on the left. At least that's how it's worked when I've used it. So it's just something to think about as you are writing your own rubrics, if you're writing your own rubrics. And if you're working in Canvas, it's also really easy to switch the order of those columns if you are building rubrics through Canvas. So after rubrics, we've got to annotating assignments and talking about how do we mark up our students' assignments and how do we support them by marking up their assignments. So effective feedback that we are writing on assignments should contain both verification and elaboration. So verification first is the information that you have provided correct or not? It's very simple, very straightforward. Is it correct? Is it accurate? This is a little bit harder when we have writing assignments. So maybe you are working in the Department of English, or you're working in creative writing, or you're working in a history course or humanities where there's writing going on. Sometimes verification isn't super easy to identify, but you might be able to say, oh yeah, that's factual information, great. Elaboration is information to guide the reader toward a correct answer or to changing their work. So elaboration is saying, okay, you got the right answer, but maybe we could have put it in this light, or maybe we could have framed it in this way. So adding a little bit more than just saying, yep, you're right, or no, you're wrong, guiding them a little bit more in their learning process. One thing to consider though, is that you spend a lot of time grading. I know you do, because I have spent those times grading as well. And we can't always provide a lot of feedback if we are trying to grade 48 papers or 50 papers or 100 papers. And what we should be considering is scaffolded feedback, because our students are also overwhelmed by the amount of feedback that they get. Let's say they're getting 10 feedback notes from you on a single assignment. They're going to be overwhelmed by all the information that you are giving them. So consider whether it's appropriate to give them scaffolded feedback. Okay, you've got another writing assignment coming up in 2 weeks. What small changes would be meaningful to take this current writing assignment and make it better for the next one? So you're scaffolding them, you're building it up so that they're going up stepwise as opposed to trying to jump up an entire hill. Scaffolding is a really great way to support learners, especially learners who are relatively weak in academics. Scaffolding is a really great strategy because you're building steps in to the learning process for them. And then there's two feedback approaches that you can take. You can take considerations for the author or actionable items. These sound very odd, but they're things you're probably already doing. Considerations for the author are maybe questions that you're asking them. Have you ever considered this thing? Or when you were writing about Emily Bronte's work, did you consider this point that someone might be making or that the author might be making? Or when you're talking about costuming in the 1800s, did you ever consider this? So things to get the author thinking. So that's one thing you can do to provide feedback. Or you can provide actionable items. So things that the author can take action on. So you're telling them, here's an issue that they can specifically take action on. For example, you're using a lot of comma splices here, or you've included unclear antecedents in your work. That's an actionable item. They can immediately make that change. As opposed to, this writing is bad. They can't do anything about that because you haven't told them what is bad about their writing. You want to tell them specifically what is that action you want them to take. Or writing is in first person, please change to third person, or please change to second person, or something like that. So actionable items is another approach you can take to feedback, giving them that action that they must do to make that improvement. I'm not going to go over all 12 of these actions of effective feedback and feed forward design. This comes from Carol Evans, who wrote a meta-analysis about assessment feedback in higher education from, I believe it was 500 papers. 500 research papers about feedback in education. I'm going to go through a couple of them because I do think that they're important. But if you want to take a quick screenshot of this, if you want to read the entire paper, Carol Evans is amazing and has written really, really great work. The ones I want to go over are some things that are valuable to us that don't take much time. So first is ensuring guidance about assessment is integrated into all teaching sessions. Our students often forget that we're assessing them at all times, whether it's we're just assessing the way they're conversing with their peers, or we're assessing the actual assignments they're turning in. We're constantly looking at how are they learning and are they learning about whatever topic I'm teaching them. So talking to them about how they're being assessed is really important. I know for courses that I've taught here, we talk about assessment at the very beginning of the course. We reference it a couple times throughout the course. We talk about ways they can prepare for assessments throughout the course. So we integrate that into our own teaching. So that's really important to just let them know that they are going to be assessed. They don't need to worry about it, but the more often you have that conversation, the less stressful assessment will be for students. The next thing is about virtual learning, because many of us are in a virtual time right now. And Carol actually talks a little bit about virtual learning, is that resources should be available to students through some sort of virtual learning environment when possible to enable them to take responsibility for their own learning. So that means that everyone has access to those course materials. So maybe you're using a textbook and not everyone is able to get the textbook right out at the start of the semester. Having digital copies of that so that all students can take ownership of their own learning. We don't want to be a barrier to their own learning processes. So some things to just think about in your own classes. This might mean that you're working with the professor that you're working with to ensure that they have these materials ready to go. So that you're able to support those students. And then the last one is giving clear and focused feedback on how students can improve their work, including signposting the most important areas to address, meaning that you find those big key areas that you want them to address and you work with them on those first. If we can tackle the big areas, we are much more likely to improve their overall work as opposed to just nitpicking the tiny little things. So maybe you're teaching a course and you're seeing a lot of spelling errors, but you're also seeing that they have no thesis. Work on the thesis first. That's much more important than their spelling errors because it's probably making up a higher portion of how you are evaluating them in the course. And some resources that you can use. I told you that we would talk a little bit about some resources, and I'm gonna show you a really great example that I hope you're using. And if you're not using, hopefully you use it from now on. And it's in Canvas SpeedGrader specifically. So Canvas SpeedGrader, obviously, if you're using Canvas through FSU, helps us reduce grading biases if done properly. And I'm gonna show you how to do that. The reviewer can provide direct feedback on the written work. You can attach rubrics to any assignments that you're assigning through Canvas. And peer review is an option that you can assign so that students can review each other's work and see how they are doing and how their peers are doing in the class. We can also provide explicit rubrics. So if you have any questions about rubric design, I'd be happy to talk about those later or after, or to meet with you one-on-one and talk about rubrics and give you some examples. And then one of the other things that you can do, and this really helps to narrow down the amount of time you're providing feedback on individual assignments, is providing group feedback slides. So let's say, for example, I'm teaching a course and I noticed that all of my students had incorrect information in one of the sections of the assignment. Maybe they're writing about the evolution of ballet from the 19th century to the 21st century. I don't know, that's just a topic I just came up with, we're going with it. And maybe they all have some incorrect information about part of the dance style. Instead of writing that comment on every single person's paper, it would be really beneficial in your next class after you finish grading on them to go over a group feedback slide to say, here's what I noticed went really well on our papers as a class. Here are some examples of things though that almost every single one of us put in our papers that I want to address so that they're not alone in thinking that I'm the only one who made this mistake, that they realize it was a group problem and you can tackle it efficiently together. And it may support students who are worried about their performance. They can see that other students are just like them in making some of these mistakes that you're going over, so they don't feel left out or isolated in this process. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to share a little Canvas example. So I'm in SpeedGrader right now for a course that I taught a while ago. And by a while ago, I mean in the fall.
Aaron?
Yes.
Sorry, I have to leave soon. So I was just wondering if I could ask you a question now.
Yep, sure.
So I have, I've had some students saying that, well, that lab quizzes are too short. Mm-hmm. And well, maybe they are, but they're kind of designed to be short. You know, they're just to be like, what is this animal? Like, what phylum is it? Go. So how do it can be hard to explain to them, like, why it's important to know these things quickly. Because their argument is like, well, if I thought about for long enough, like if I had 10 minutes to think about it, then I would know.
Mm-hmm. So what I would suggest in that situation is you put it in the context of here is why we have designed it to be this way. Here's the expectation for the course. This is an animal diversity course. And our expectation is that the material that you are learning in this course is firsthand knowledge by the time you're getting to that assessment. That means that they are preparing themselves in advance, they're making flashcards, and they're self-testing and self-regulating their testing skills to be ready to get to that quiz portion. The other thing to include in that, though, is to remind them that that's not the only way they're being assessed in the course. So it's not just the only way that you're assessing their understanding of the material. You're assessing them through worksheets that they're turning in or the exams where they get a little bit more time on. So that's a good way to start the conversation with them, definitely. And then if those concerns keep coming up, that's definitely a conversation to have with the design team for that course to say, hey, here's some feedback I'm getting from students. Does anyone else have the same feedback? How can we work with that maybe to improve this course a little bit?
Yeah, I try to tell them that like if they're going to go into zoology, that they kind of do need to know it quickly, but some of them don't want to go to zoology, even though it's an animal diversity lab, which I'm like, why are you taking this lab if you don't want to be a zoologist? But I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Good thing to think about. And if we want to, I can meet with you one-on-one and we can talk more about that too.
Cool.
So back to Canvas. I'm just looking at time just to see how much time we've got. We're doing great on time. So thanks everyone for your paying attention. I see lots of things going on in chat that I'll check later. But this is Canvas, and this is a fake student that we have in Canvas for one of our courses. So this is test student, you can see. And this is SpeedGrader. Now the student doesn't have a submission because our fake student doesn't submit anything, but you can see that the rubric is built right into the assignment. So this is what students would see as they're turning their assignment in, and I can click through and assign the specific score for the different category, what we're looking at. The one thing I want to really point out here is a feature of Canvas that I don't know a lot of people are using, and it helps reduce grading biases. We're looking to make our courses as with as little bias as possible. So up here in the top left, this gear sign right here has options, and then it pops up the SpeedGrader options, and you can click to hide the names in SpeedGrader. And when I do that, if I save my settings, it's going to save this entire thing, and it will go back. And none of the students' names will be visible if this loads. It'll just give them random student numbers so that their names aren't visible. That way, if they don't put their names on assignments, you don't know exactly who the student is that is submitting that work. I'm going to try reloading my page because it's deciding it doesn't want to load. But trust me, it shows up with just numbers. And you can change that. You can turn it on and off if you have a reason to do that. But it's a really great way to reduce grading biases and to make sure that you are grading students' work objectively instead of subjectively. There we go. Perfect. So now you can see student 638. This is a test student. I know it's a test student because it's the one I'm currently on. But now all of the students in my course, I don't know who they are. There's a lot of them in the course that I can look through. And if I go to one of them, I've got to find a specific student to go to. We can look at some of the different ways that we can provide feedback to our students. We can actually click directly in to the assignments that they're on, and I don't want to give away, oh, there they are. going to say, I don't want to give away any specific student information. I know that this one doesn't have the student's name on it, which is why I'm sharing it with all of you. It just has their TA on it. But in Canvas, if you're not aware of this, you can annotate directly in students' assignments. So for example, if I think that there's an issue with this first sentence here, I can click on the highlighter tool. I can highlight this first sentence, and then it allows me to add a comment directly to the paper. That's what I mean about targeted feedback. Instead of providing feedback over on the side or in the rubric, I can say, this specific area of your paper, here's the issue that I am seeing. You can also add little blurb notes. So if you just have a note for the overall structure of something, you can put that there. You can include text notes. You can even strike out words. So maybe there's a word that is not needed in the sentence, they're being redundant. You can do strikeouts as well in their paper. And the students can see these feedback items that you are giving them so that when they go to look at their work, they can specifically see, oh, here's the issue that my TA has identified in my work. And you can pair that along with the rubric. So it's a really great way to link the rubric as well as what you're actually seeing in their written work. So just something to think about as you are grading using Canvas SpeedGrader, which is a really great way to provide support to our students. Again, those group feedback slides are really great resource to be using, and explicit rubrics, as I've talked about, and our puppy has decided to come see me. So a quick note about socio-emotional feedback and how we can provide that in our classroom for our students. So we've got verbal cues and nonverbal cues as part of our socio-emotional feedback. So verbal cues, when we're talking to our students and we're giving them feedback in the classroom, we wanna be as specific as possible. I don't wanna go into class and be like, great job, Abby, because Abby doesn't know what she did a great job on. Did she do a great job of showing up on time, or did she do the experiment properly? And I know that sounds silly, but a lot of times we give feedback that we actually don't want to be giving. We say things to people just because we want to be nice. And part of being feedback is being, or part of giving feedback is being really honest and open with our students to say, here's what I really liked that you did, or here's something you did that wasn't great, and here's how we can make improvements. So we want to be specific with our verbal cues. You can save time grading and cut down on long-winded text annotations by providing direct verbal feedback to students in the classroom. And it's actually shown to be even more valuable for students from underrepresented groups. In a study on giving feedback to groups at the college level, they found that students from underrepresented groups, including minority students, including female students, including Black students, including first-year college students, were more perceptive to verbal feedback than to written feedback, because there is more emotion behind verbal feedback and there's a person giving them that verbal feedback as opposed to the computer screen showing them that written feedback or the person being detached from that written feedback. And they found that feedback that provides only the right answer has an effect size of 0.22. So feedback that's only telling you what the right answer is might improve someone's activity by 22%. Well, explanatory feedback, explaining that process and explaining why it's the right answer, has an effect size of 0.53. So more than double the effect of just providing here's the right answer. So being explicit has its benefits as well. Nonverbal cues, really, really hard in the classroom. I know this as someone who speaks sign language. Nonverbal cues is a huge part of sign language because I can sign something with my hands. And if my face is doing something different and the emotions I'm showing on my face are different, I'm giving two very different messages as I'm talking or working with an individual. And so nonverbal cues are really powerful, especially in our distance learning classes. There was a recent study that I actually just heard about on the radio the other day that they found that, or the authors suggested that distance learning classes through Zoom are more intimate than in-person classes, which is why we get a little bit more tired because we're having to constantly have our cameras on. We're seeing people a lot closer than we're used to. We're seeing that face-to-face communication. And so it might be even more valuable for us to be providing nonverbal cues in our classroom. So being careful about the way that we are composing ourselves, the things that are in our backgrounds, nonverbal cues can be really powerful. It's also a really great way to show students about who you are as a person by having really interesting things in your backgrounds. Maybe you've got a cool flag from a country that you're from, or maybe you visited a cool place and you've got some souvenirs in your background. My background is really boring and plain because my computer green screen thinks that I am the green screen. And so it colors me whatever shade that I want to turn on. So I just have this plain, boring background, but I try to wear something that shows my personality a little bit. So today I'm wearing some of my army gear when I'm talking for the army, just gives a little bit more personality in those nonverbal cues. And attention to nonverbal cues was actually found to be a determining factor in teacher success in a survey of students. They found that nonverbal cues, so the way that we're moving about the classroom, the way that we're standing, the way that we are posturing ourselves, the way that we are looking about and responding to student questions was found to be a determining factor in teacher success. So more successful teachers were better able to control their nonverbal feedback. And my opinion is that more workshops and training materials should be provided on nonverbal feedback, but I know that's very hard. So we will focus on the things that I can clearly help you out with. Nonverbal feedback, that's a whole nother ball game, but maybe something to think about. Maybe go practice in front of a mirror and do like little facial exercises and acting exercises, just things to really think about how you respond to different situations. And last but not least, in methods for receiving feedback, if you're interested in getting feedback from your own students, you can use Zoom polls. You can use Kahoot games. If you're familiar with Kahoot, it's free. You can use it. It's really easy. You could use Google Forms. Google Forms are really great for end surveys that you have. Or you can have conversations during your class time, talking with students, because not all feedback needs to be, oh, I don't like this thing you're doing, or, oh, how am I doing? It could be, how are you doing? And that could be a reflection of how you as an educator are providing materials to your own students. So just some things to think about as you receive feedback. And obviously we have the FSU teacher evaluations, the TA evaluations, if you've taught at the university that you get, and we'll talk about those in a little bit and how we can incorporate those feedback. Okay, with that, how do we use our feedback to support students? And I'm about to hit you with a hot take of the day because I love hot takes. I love controversy in education. I also love this meme. So here is my hot take of the day. If you don't have time to give feedback, then you have absolutely no right to give that assignment. There is no purpose in giving an assignment if you're not going to evaluate that work and give some sort of feedback to the student. Now, the evaluation, the feedback that you provide could be a score. Scores are feedback because they let the learner know how they're doing. It could be a comment, it could be a note, it could be a great job, I really like the way that you worded this sentence, but you should not be giving assignments to students if you're not going to provide them with feedback, okay? For those of you who are thinking, oh my goodness, I've done this before in my life, I'm a terrible person. No, you just didn't know these specific things because you may not have training in these specific areas. So consider, is this assignment doing something for the students? Are they getting something out of this assignment? And can I give them something more by providing them with this assignment? So just some things to think about as you are providing feedback to your students that you really want to make it targeted, you want to make it impactful for your students as they proceed throughout their educational careers. There is a continuum of assessment. I'm not going to bother going through all of it because assessment is a long continuum from student to standard, so from basically where they are to where the goals are. And there's different ways that we can provide assessments and feedback throughout assessments, throughout this assessment continuum. A lot of times we think about summative assessments, which is like the final, here's the final goal that they must reach, here is the final item that I am assessing them on. We can also have formative assessments. So they inform our instruction. That's what formative assessments do. Maybe that's a quick survey. Maybe that's a quick non-graded quiz. It's a Kahoot game, et cetera. And then we can have benchmark assessments as well, where we give assessments at key times to evaluate where students are currently, and then to predict where students are going to be moving toward. Great benchmark assessments are first drafts of writing assignments. Those are great benchmarks of where's the student currently and can I predict where they are going to be at the end of this? So just something to think about. This is from California. public schools. California is one of the top states for education. So a lot of resources that come out of California are awesome and super great to read if you're interested in reading educational literature. So some challenges with feedback and how do we improve? We're at the challenges portion because there are some challenges with giving feedback. So number one, students may not be appreciative of feedback for several reasons. They might be dissatisfied with the comments. They might not agree with your comments. That's a very common one. Timeliness, we might not be able to give feedback in the appropriate amount of time. And the relevance of the feedback. You might be giving feedback on something and they don't see how that's relevant. Maybe they made an error and it's not really in the rubric and you're still taking points off that or commenting on that. Maybe they don't think it's appropriate to their work. But students do really want feedback. That is the thing. They want direct feedback rather than general feedback. So providing direct guided feedback on their work is really, really valuable. And there is such a thing as too much feedback. Nobody has defined how much feedback is too much feedback, but we have defined that there is such a thing as too much feedback. And so think about, am I providing an appropriate amount of feedback that the student can make changes in all of these before the next assignment that they are turning in? So I like to keep it short and simple, no more than 5 items of feedback for a really large assignment, because they should be meaningful things that the student can make improvements on before they get the next assignment that they are doing or the next assessment of sorts. Again, there is no exact number. It's something that you will have to figure out on your own. But realize that if a student has turned in a 1-paragraph assignment and you have 15 items of feedback on there, you've gone a little bit overboard. Relax, take a deep breath, maybe take a step back and think about which of these 15 items are the most important and provide the student with those specific items. So what I want to do is practice giving feedback and then talking strategy on giving feedback. So if you registered before today, you should have gotten a PDF document that has a quick little grading item on it. And I'll share that with you so that you can see exactly what I'm talking about. It looks like this. So it's a little 1-page, pretty short thing. And there is a rubric at the bottom of it. And I want you to grade this. And by grade this, I mean, I want you to just go through it. You don't need to painstakingly grade this. I want you to just, how would you evaluate this work? A note that if you are using a PDF editor like Adobe that I'm currently in, there's probably a comment button over here on the side that allows you to provide feedback. So if I click on comment, then I can highlight sections and then I can write comments if I'm interested in writing things. This is nice. I don't know, whatever feedback you want to write. Or if you're not interested in doing that, the rubric down here, the boxes are checkable. So you can check the boxes that you want to give to that student. So there are some grading categories here. So take some time right now, take about, let's say 5 minutes to do this so that we have enough time to come back together. Take some time, grade this, and then we'll come back together in about 5 minutes. Some of the things that you did in that assignment. I want to talk about some feedback misconceptions that you might have fell victim to or might have experienced in your time. And maybe you can see them as you evaluated that. So the one size fits all model is a misconception that every student needs the exact same type of feedback. You're very well aware that our students are individuals and need individual learning needs sometimes. And so providing the exact same feedback to all students might be misconstrued by each individual student. So just think about, what am I providing? Is it very clear to everyone? Is it objective, or am I accidentally including subjective information in that feedback? The second one is probably the biggest misconception in all of feedback. And sometimes we are taught to give the sandwich feedback method. So I'm going to give you a beneficial statement, so a supporting statement, you did this really great thing, but then I'm going to put this kind of critical statement in the middle, and then I'm going to support it on the bottom with another like, you're amazing, I love your face, I don't know, something like nice and supportive at the end. And a major research study actually found that sandwich feedback makes students less critical of themselves. They think they're better, their work is better than it is. And it also makes them think less of their instructor, which is really interesting. So this sandwich feedback method is really invaluable because it makes our students think that they're not doing poorly, and it makes them have a worse relationship with their instructor. So something to think about is that you can provide supportive feedback of, oh, this was a really great thing that you did, but try to stay away from always going, you know, critical, supportive, that kind of thing. Be very specific. We already talked about adversity to feedback. People are not adverse to feedback. Feedback does not always occur at the summation of learning. Feedback should be an ongoing process throughout learning. As we've talked about, there's different ways to provide feedback in different stages of learning. And then last but not least, for those of us who are teaching in person, this is a huge debate in the field of education. It's called the red pen debate. For a while, educators would only grade with red pen. And there was a study that found that students who get grades with red pen feel worse than students who receive grades with other colors of pen. And so for a while, teachers switched pen colors. I don't really have much opinion on this. I think it's a really interesting debate, but it doesn't really matter what pen color you're using. It should be more about the actual feedback that you are providing to students. So whatever pen color you want to use, feel free to use it. Just realize that there is a debate going on about the color that we are using when we are marking papers. We also need to teach how to incorporate feedback. And I'm going to go through this rather quickly because I want to also get to how do we as educators incorporate feedback into our own teaching practices. So just some general notes is that we want to try to build feedback reception into our class structures. So maybe taking time for students to get assignments back in person and for them to actually go over the feedback items that they've received and to think about the information that they've received and how they can improve in their next assignment or in the next step for the process. You can also have students practice giving assignment feedback, so providing examples to students and having them work on those examples of, I'm going to generate this feedback for this individual, or I'm going to grade this example using the rubric. You can ask students to submit informal responses to self-assessment questions, so along with the assignment. So how do you think you did? What changes did you make from this assignment to the previous one? How did you improve from a previous assignment to this one? So having students self-assess might be a valuable way to incorporate feedback into our students' own learning practices. And last but not least, how and when should we incorporate feedback that we as educators receive? So how do we get feedback? We talked a little bit about this already, is that we can receive feedback from our peers. So maybe you have a peer who wants to come watch you teach and they might give you feedback. You can invite them in. That's a really great thing to do. You can use data that you already have from assessments or surveys. You can use mid-course feedback if you give a survey in the middle of a course, or you can share some responses with students to show that you are paying attention to their feedback so that they're more likely to provide feedback to you if they know that you as the instructor are willing to make changes, a really valuable thing to do. But incorporating everyone's feedback is actually a bad idea, research shows. So this is the main thing I want to talk about here is this work done by Franklin in a study on how to incorporate student feedback into teaching practices. Franklin suggested response rates shown here for student surveys. So based on your class size, the recommended minimum response rate of when should I be paying attention to this feedback? So if you're thinking about your teaching survey that your students might be filling out if you're TAing here at the university, think about this information of, is this survey response valid? Is it meaningful for me to incorporate? Because what we actually find is that surveys are really biased. There are two groups of individuals who generally fill out survey feedback. It's the students who really love you and the students who really hate you. And nobody in the middle tends to fill it out. There's no medium ground, no middle ground. And so you tend to have, oh yeah, this person was amazing. I love everything they did. This was a really great course. And then you have the students who are like, this person's the worst person who's ever taught me before. I think that they're terrible. I think that they shouldn't be a teacher here. And so you're not really getting valuable feedback from either side. You're just getting really critical feedback from one side and really supportive feedback from the other side. So consider how many individuals are responding to your survey before incorporating that feedback. But when you do want to, and this is the last point I'll make, if you do want to incorporate feedback, collaborate with a colleague or a peer to determine what the feedback you've received means. Talk with somebody about it. Don't just be alone. Also, attempt to collect 360-degree feedback. So get feedback from a colleague, from your supervisor, from subordinates, from your students, from everyone around you, so that you have a good understanding of what people see in you and how people are evaluating you. And you also want to determine, if you're teaching multiple sections of a course, determine if the trend that is being talked about, if that's specific to one section. Maybe you're doing something in one of your sections that's not happening in the other. And so maybe you need to figure out, oh, I'm doing this one thing with one section, not the other. I should just make a change so that they're more even across both sections. And last but not least, as I'm a big proponent of this, set a goal. Set a goal for yourself and figure out, how am I going to assess that goal? So choose a specific task that you want to improve upon, because just like our students, we need to scaffold our own feedback and our own growth so that we don't burn out in the process of making ourselves better educators. And with that, we will go back to our goals of, we've talked about some gaps in understanding of how to use feedback for students. We've identified different types of feedback that you can provide. We recognize that there are challenges to incorporating feedback as an educator and as students, and hopefully you can apply some of these effective feedback strategies and feed forward skills in your own teaching practices as you continue in your educational journey. And with that, I will take any questions that we have. I know a lot popped up in chat while we were going through.
Thank you so much, Aaron. That was so, so cool. And I learned a lot from this as well. I was going to read two of the
questions. And Fong posted a really great peer teaching observation form link in chat if any of you are interested. Anyone can come in and want to teach and provide some really valuable feedback. It's a really, really great thing that you can get.
Yeah, that's a fantastic resource. There were two questions that happened earlier in the chat that I wanted to point out. The first.
I got a comment in chat. My department discourages rubrics because they make it far too easy to be legalistic and student grades suffer, but my students want rubrics and I'm sympathetic to the request for clarity. What should I do? That's a really, really great question. So one thing we don't want to do is cause issues with our departments, because obviously we are working for the university as teaching assistants, or if you're a professor, we don't want to cause disparities in that. However, there's no reason why you can't have your own rubric as you're going through for grading, so that when a student comes to you to say, okay, why did I earn this grade? You can pull out your grading rubric to say, here's the clear things that I saw in your writing. So it's a resource for you to be using. Even if the department is saying, we're not going to officially use these, you can still have those to support your grading. And that also makes it more likely that your grading will be even across all students, so that you won't be making subjective categories or subjective decisions from one student to another. Looking down just to see. Grading anonymously works for equality, but doesn't it make equity more difficult? So I really love the interest in equity versus equality. I think this is a concept that in education gets very much overlooked, because when we think of equality, equality is everyone gets the exact same thing, whereas equity gets what you deserve or what you need, essentially. And a really great example of this is there's a comic strip where it shows individuals and there's a fence and they're trying to see over the fence to see the baseball game. And so equality is giving everyone the exact same height stool to stand on, but some of the individuals can't see over the fence. And then there is an equity one where they give a scaffolded set of stools so that the shortest individual can still see over the fence, but everyone can see over the fence. And then there's one that says, well, why don't we just make it like a wire fence so that you can see through the fence and everyone can still see the game. Grading anonymously definitely works for equality. It makes equity more difficult, but I don't know that that's a bad thing in grading, because grading should be objective and not subjective at all. We are grading the object, the item that the person has presented to us. We shouldn't be grading based on any biases we might have about the student or where they were or where they're going, because grading, we should have one standard for everybody, unless your course has multiple standards that you use for grading. And so I think that when we're grading based on equality, and then equity could be the way that we're working with our students to support them from how they did or how they're going, or maybe they need a little bit more support. But that's a really, really great point Thanks for that information. Oh yeah, Lauren pointed out a really great thing for the student number that I was talking about with when it provides anonymously, it's the letter that they are in the grade book. I know that that's a terrible thing that Canvas does, and it just like randomly gives them letters according to their name. I try my best to forget their last names because that makes it a whole lot easier, but I do know that that's not the best thing, unfortunately, that it does. You can also have it arrange it in a random order so you can sort them by when it was turned in so that instead of grading 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, it might be 13, 27, 4, 2, because it's based on the time they turned it in, which makes it a lot harder for you to remember the order of students in your class. So that's a really, really great point. Thanks for that information. Oh yeah, Katie, it's not, your audio is not coming through, I'm sorry. Maybe something's up with my headphones.
Let's see, let me test. Can you hear me now?
Looking to see if there's anything else in chat, but if anyone has questions, feel free to shout them out. Or again, I know that my email was put in chat a couple of times. I'm happy to have one-on-one conversations with anyone. I love teaching. I thought it was what I was gonna do for the rest of my life until I decided, you know what? I love teaching a lot, but I also love teaching things I'm passionate about, which was marine sciences and not necessarily general sciences, which is why I came back. But I love teaching and sitting in on classes and providing support. Professors have asked for support from me to help guide some of their courses. And especially with online learning, if you're nervous about something, happy to help out. And I know the PI team is amazing about helping out with any design things or if you're working on rubrics or other than that. Oh, thanks, Katie. Yeah, that my earphones might be cutting out. These are cheap $20 earphones that you get in COVID times. And it looks like Katie's typing the last question in chat for me too. Oh, great question. So if you're unsure of the exact number of mistakes, should you avoid including a number? So that's probably talking about rubric generation and how do we decide the specific criteria for rubric. If you are unsure of the exact number of mistakes, you should probably just think about what am I really looking for? Like what makes an excellent paper? If I see, you know, 5 mistakes, can I still say it's an excellent paper in this category? I would try to do my best to create some level of assessment because that makes it easier to do the exact number of mistakes. Or if you are maybe someone who struggles with spelling and grammar, or maybe your second language is English, and so you're still working on understanding all of the nuances of English, you can have a couple of different options. Number one is that you can work with somebody else to help you grade that specific section. That's not unheard of having someone support you by saying, I don't know all the spelling issues, talking with your supervisor, talking with someone else in the department to say, I need help with this, can you support me? I'm sure that someone would reach out to say yes. You also can think about, is spelling and grammar really an important thing to be grading somebody on? Does it matter to this assignment? We've been taught from a very young age that spelling and grammar is so important. I remember having spelling and grammar tests when I was in school, but now that we use things like texting language and now that platforms like TikTok encourage the use of slang and now that there are really interesting dialects of English that are being spoken and written, maybe spelling and grammar isn't the most important thing to be doing or to be looking at in writing. So you have a couple options there. You also could do the option of clearly legible or like it could be read without stuttering, including some information in there that might be a little bit more subjective. And if you have to have a subjective category, I would suggest just making sure that you are trying to be as consistent as possible in evaluating that category. So after you grade all those papers, look at, okay, what are the grades across that one category? Are they rather heterogeneous or are they homogeneous? If they're heterogeneous, maybe my grading wasn't the best. Maybe I was really lenient in some areas and not lenient in the other papers, and maybe I should take a second look at that. But you can always get a second pair of eyes on anything you grade. Don't think that you can't. And thank you all for coming. Again, if you're interested, my email is in chat or come to the bio page and you can find me. A big thank you again to Katie, Melanie, and Dr. Lesano for this amazing opportunity. Feel free to go to the next PI workshop. I'm sure there's going to be another valuable one before the end of the semester. And if you have questions, feel free to reach out and contact any of us, and we'd be happy to help.